All right. Hey, hi. How are you? How are you doing? Are you doing well? I'm doing okay. I'm doing all right. I hope you're doing well. I was in a bit of a funk, like November, December into the beginning of January. And I feel like end of January through February, I'm kind of back on my grind. I'm kind of back in the game. But yeah, I don't know. Things are going on. Like, I feel I'm having a lot of issues with impatience. And I'm really annoyed with people who have poor spatial reasoning and can't manage their spatial relationships well, spatial awareness, you know? So I'm like, I'm noticing a lot of impatience and a lot of aggravation, a lot of irritation. and I think it has something to do with the fact that just like my professional life has slowed down. I haven't been getting as many work opportunities as I want to be getting, as I need to be getting in order to be feeling like I'm staying ahead and I'm continuing to crush. I'm working a lot. Like I'm doing, and by which I mean, I'm doing a lot of creative things. I'm making a lot of content. I'm making comedy sketches with Colin and Kara and Sid and Olivia and Scumbag Dad. And we're having a good time. And I'm making YouTube exclusive content, video essays, and they're fun. And they're coming out at a nice clip, like almost one a week. The podcast is kind of back up and running. I'm doing a lot of things, but I'm just not getting paid to do a lot of things. And I'm feeling that pressure, that capitalistic pressure that I, you know, if I'm not earning, I'm yearning. If I'm not making bank, then I'm smelling rank. I'm just coming up with these rhymes off the top of my head. If I'm not earning dough, then it's like, oh no, is where I'm at. Okay. Doesn't matter that I need, you know, it's nice to have this time. I have extra time to like focus on songwriting. I'm taking a playwriting workshop right now, and I'm working on a play that I wrote a few years ago, and we're doing a new draft of it that I think is a lot better. And having this extra time and this extra space is allowing me to invest more in just the craft of what it is that I do. And that's good, but I just like, I'm nervous about the money thing, you know? And so I think that that's bleeding into a lot of other areas in my life where I'm having a lot of irritation and a lot of impatience. And I don't know. I just wanted to say that at the top of the show. I don't know why. On that tip, on the tip of Austin's feeling the pressure of the money, patreon.com/AustinArcher. We've got a bunch of lovely people over there who have been supporting me for a while now. And it's a very, very small but loyal and fierce handful of people. And boy, if you've got the means, if you like this show, if you like the stuff that I do, and if you want to help me feel slightly less pressed, if you want to help me feel slightly less irritable and stressed out, patreon.com/AustinArcher. We'd love to have your support over there. Or, you know, if that feels like too much, if committing to just another monthly subscription feels like too much, maybe you want to add to your vinyl collection. You want to have some physical media in your possession, and you're trying to build a small arsenal of vinyl in your life. My double vinyl, Beautiful Things, the deluxe edition, is available to you. And you can find that at the links in all of my bios or by going to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. It's all there. And you can help this show out that way. We've got an amazing episode, a really great episode. I don't want to like do too much front loading here. I sort of give the breakdown of what happened in the conversation. You're going to hear it again, but like, I'll just say like, yeah, this is a person who like, I think I'm very politically aligned with in most ways. And we had like this little interaction that happens between content creators from time to time where I made a video, she made a response video, I made a response video to her response video. This is how content creators communicate with each other from sometimes it can be very contentious when two content creators are making response videos back and forth to each other. It's usually a sign that they're like not agreeing on something and that they have beef, and they're not talking to each other directly. They're just talking to each other indirectly through their audiences and through response videos. And Leah and I decided to just not do that and instead get on the podcast and talk about sort of our visions for the future and for the political future of the species and of the country and all of that stuff. And she really blew my hair back and did a fantastic job. She's an incredibly well-spoken and well-thought-out political commentator, and I feel really lucky to have her on the show, and I think you're all really going to enjoy this conversation. So let's just get into it, shall we? From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and I'm talking with my new friend, Leah, about the future. Alrighty, we are here, and Leah is here, and we have done our pre-show rant about how terrible being a content creator and being involved in that never-ending hall of horrors is, and how wonderful it is to be sort of beholden to the mindless...
Faceless
AI brain that controls all of our destinies. Oh my God, Lil Everett Yoakum is here. I haven't seen Everett forever. Everett used to pop into my live streams all the time and tell me to tell Mr. Chamberlain, which is Kevin Chamberlain. He used to tell me to tell Kevin Chamberlain yodelay hee hoo. He used to pop in every single time, and I haven't seen you in forever.
Just to remind you?
Yeah, just to remind me.
I'm glad that it stayed the same.
Yep, and he popped back in years later and was like, have you told him yet? Amazing. Great, cool. Thrilled to have you here. We've been trying to get this scheduled for a few weeks now. I think that, first of all, give the people, the audience, if they don't know, a little information on yourself, who you are, what the work is that you're doing, where they can find you on social media, all that stuff.
Yeah, will do. So my name's Leah, and I mainly talk politics, specifically left politics, which I think is why Austin and I have found each other's platforms. And you can find me at, God, I always forget that I'm going to have to, for the rest of my life, say this out loud. This is the name that I chose. Socialist Sleuths, as in S-L-O-O-T-S. That
is that like
one.
A play on like sluts? Like, is it like sleuths?
You know, I can't believe that I have to say this on a podcast nevertheless, but do you know Blue Mountain State?
No.
Good, good. Keep it that way. I hope that no one in your audience knows it either, but there's a character who always says, instead of sluts, he says sleuths. And so I was like, this is, originally I was drawing socialist pinups. So that's how it all started. And now here we are. And I do art, and I do make anti-capitalist art, but then you can also find me on TikTok at, again, I didn't give myself anything easy here. It's PTITE_LIA. It's Petite Leah because I'm French also. So I was like, I'll just make it a cool French word. And now I get tagged in all of these Pakistani videos. But that's unimportant.
Are you French? Is your family, you have like yes. French family?
Yeah, I'm dual citizen. So I have to vote in both elections. So in the French elections for Macron versus Le Pen, and then here.
No way. Oh my God. Yeah. That's crazy.
I also speak French at home.
Wow. I have a brother who's from France. And I mean, like my family did this. We did this weird thing when I was growing up where like some kid would be in town on a foreign exchange program and they would just wind up at our house and then they would just never leave and they would just become part of the family. Like Cyril came and stayed with us. He was supposed to stay with us for a year. That was over 20 years ago. It was like 25 years ago. And he's married now and just, you know, lives a few towns over from my parents, got married in my parents' backyard. And like, he's just like part of the family now.
And where is he from?
Oh God, I should know that.
No, you don't. That's totally fine.
It's I'm from somewhere in France is he from. He is from somewhere in France where his family is from and they all speak French.
Hell yeah. Specific enough.
Yeah. Yeah. But he's essentially my big brother. And like, I grew up with him like as my big brother. And then I also have a sister from Micronesia who did the same thing, who was just in town. She was like
parents. How many siblings do you have that are unrelated to these exchange trips?
The siblings that came out of my mother's womb, I have three. So there's four of us. And then my mom was just always finding ways to bring more people into the Archer household. Home. Yeah. Yeah.
I respect that. As someone who did do a few exchange programs, a part of me is kind of glad that I didn't end up staying where I was. However, there are a few places where if they had offered, I may have taken them up on it.
Yeah.
Like, especially in some parts of France, like that, those places are cute. I don't know where you're from in the US though. So I don't know if I would want.
I'm from Utah. So I do think it's kind of weird.
Wait, that's not bad. That's not the worst though. That's not the, I'm from Georgia. So so like for me, I'm like, if I left the south of France on the Mediterranean Sea, you can bet that I'm not staying in Georgia. Like, I just can't. I already got out when I could.
I think everyone always has like a lower opinion of the place that they're from though. Cause I'm like, I've never been to Georgia. Like, I want to see what Georgia's like, you know?
You may want to see Atlanta, but not right now. Not with all the political stuff. Maybe like, no, it's kind of just going downhill. It was fine when I was a kid though. No, it really wasn't. I hate Georgia. I will stay on.
I have not spent a lot of time in like the true American South. I just haven't spent much time like traveling and perusing those areas.
I don't want to jump the gun, but I do wonder, and remind me to circle back to this, but I do wonder if that impacts, because I always get curious when I talk to like one of my closest friends. He doesn't always agree with me, and I know that that's also what we're going to talk about later, but one of the things that I love is trying to get to like the root of like potentially why, based off of our lived experiences, we would have gotten, especially since we share so much of the same knowledge, why we would have gotten to two different strategies. And I wonder if that's also part of what's impacting both of our opinions on the status quo, but we will save that for later.
Mm, yeah, that's fair. That's a really interesting point. But lest we get all the way down that rabbit hole, I know that especially on YouTube where people watch, they accuse me of padding a lot. That's a thing. It's a big YouTube comment thing, is like too much padding on this video. And it means that like you—
Is it like fluff?
Yeah, it's like you took too long to get to the main topic. Like you took, you know, and I always try to explain to people that I'm like, I have never once in my life been editing a video and thinking to myself, how can I make this longer? Like that has just never, ever once come into my brain while I'm editing a video. I am always trying to make the video shorter. And people are like, you added padding to this so that the runtime would be longer. I'm like, I assure you I did not. I assure you.
I cut out large chunks.
Yeah, I cut out over 45 minutes of me talking from this video. If I had wanted to pad it, believe you me, I could have. But I want to get into like what brings us together today on the podcast. I think that, yeah, we do have very similar political philosophies and ideologies and viewpoints and perspectives on a lot of things. I have a video on my YouTube channel called Arguing with People I Don't Disagree With. And the genesis for that video was that I had made a TikTok video that had a rough analogy of like a current, try to like sketch out version of like where our current political, you know, dilemma.
Sketch is also maybe doing some heavy lifting here. Let's be honest. It was doodle. A doodle on bad, a piece of paper.
Yeah, bad doodle. And then as happens with analogies, a lot of people were like, here are all the problems with your analogy. And it's like, well, yeah. And it's like, and of course, it's an incomplete analogy for the totality of the political experience in America. I was trying to argue for like a very specific thing, but you made a response video where you offered a revised version of the analogy that felt more like it, maybe a more accurate version of why.
Again,
a revised doodle analogy. And then I made my video going, this is where I feel like I find myself a lot lately, especially in a post October 7th environment, is I find myself more often than not in discussion and in debate, if that's the right word. I don't even know if it is, but in discussion, I would say debate, because a lot of times it gets pretty heated with people I don't disagree with. I'd spent a lot of my time online in the last 4 years debating ideologies with people on the right and with conservatives, and like trying to explain to conservatives the holes in their gender ideology and stuff like that. And lately I find myself in hot contention with people that I don't actually feel like I disagree with. And I actually think that like, you and I in those two videos didn't really disagree on much at all.
Yeah.
But the result of that was us talking in the DMs on Instagram and being like, it might be interesting for the two of us to actually
instead
chat.
Of making it more and more video replies to just actually go face to face.
To actually just
no,
yeah,
kidding.
And have just it talk. Out. Is that in your estimation like a reasonably accurate recap of what?
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah. I think that that's spot on. I won't even disagree that I think that I have also, and I think that, and correct me again if I'm wrong, because right off the bat, I do want to just be transparent, but I would consider myself a little more spicy left is a maybe like a little more, I don't want to say like extreme, because I do think that ultimately the end goals of us both disagreeing on the premises of capitalism, that is the same. But I think that both of us, in terms of where the left is, you would be closer to the center, not by much, but still a bit to my right and me a bit to the left. And there's obviously disagreements with how the whole compass goes. But the reason why I bring that up is because I do agree with you that I think that if you are past neoliberal or past Democrat, everyone past that is kind of just on top of each other disagreeing about a lot of more things then we are a unified front to face the other side. And I think that a part of the reason why I agree with that so much is because when I made that video, the first one responding to you, to be honest with you, I just made it because I was like, oh, I think that I could make a better doodle, no offense. That was a little more accurate. So I was like, I'll just do that. But even in the comments, and I even started the video just like you started yours, being like, I really like Austin's videos. Like Austin also, I think, appreciates my videos because he follows me. So we're like, I'm not trying to beef. But even in the way that those conversations always go, it just ends up getting, like you said, heated. So I would very much agree with how you said it went down. And not that we even got heated with each other, but I just think that people, like even in the comments, were like, I completely disagree with this, or like, I 100% agree with you and not him, and like all this other stuff. And I just think that this is long overdue and well-timed for the topic.
Yeah, absolutely. I would even, I would add to that, that I think that... more significant than like where each of us lands specifically on the spectrum of like how far left are you or how much toward the center am I? I really don't like to think of myself as a person who like leans towards center or favors center. I think it comes down to, I think the differences majorly or mainly come down to communication styles and like what is our like approach to messaging on in a public facing
forum.
Yeah,
no, it's more of like a strategy disagreement than an end goal disagreement, I would say. It's very much more so the disagreement is not, because I do think I agree that with the political spectrum, it does imply that we disagree somewhat on goals, but I don't think that we disagree at all on that. I think that it's very much just how we get there that we may not 100%. And even then, I think that we have so much overlap, which we saw in the videos, but yeah, we'll talk about it.
And even like some of that is like, it's like, is it really a disagreement if it's just a stylistic difference? Because there's some parts of content creation where it's literally just like this vibe seems to work better for me and my particular audience, or like, you know, so it's like, if, like you said, spicy, like it's like if having an approach to content that's a little more like, I'm not going to handhold you on this. I'm just going to fucking like, hey, this is why this shit's dumb. You know, like it, like that, if that approach is like a stylistic choice that seems to be a better vibe for you. And if my approach is like, I'm going to try to make sure that we're like laughing so that this medicine goes down a little easy, put a little sugar in there for you. And also try to like, but also I can be a total unrelenting asshole in my videos from time to time too. There's videos where I'm just like, oh, I'm not being nice at all in that video. And I'm not even like trying to put on a nice face in that video. But I think that, yeah, that's a thing where it's like, it's literally just like a temperament or style shift here and there that might
100%.
Be,
I mean, even just with the bus video, just for, if anyone hasn't watched it, Austin's video, and I will be upfront about this from the start, is that, and I think that this also does just reflect our two styles, is that yours was undeniably more funny. It was more humorous. It was more lighthearted. It wasn't as the world is ending as mine was. And I do think that that's not just that we may see it differently in terms of like timelines and like strategy and all that, but also just like you said, stylistically, like I'm much more blunt with my delivery than I think, which sometimes gets me in trouble. But I'm happy that it got me here. So
Yeah, cool. Okay. So that is sort of like the gist of maybe the dynamic here that we're establishing and laying out. for the audience. And I think that that's thorough enough. You know, I sort of sent you over a outline that you responded to on Instagram of like what I wanted to talk about. But you had mentioned when I first came out with my YouTube video about this exchange, you had mentioned that as far as I guess maybe end goals go, or maybe a strategy thing goes, because the title of this episode is The Future. And I think that what we're talking about is like where we both are trying to maybe nudge the nose of the ship in terms of like which direction we think would be most beneficial to get us to a place where our goals are achievable in a way that minimizes harm and all that stuff. You had mentioned that you believe that like capitalism as a system needs to be dismantled before we can build something better in its place, simply as a matter of, you know, dealing with the ticking clock of climate change. And I don't disagree with you at all on the immediacy of climate change demands and of the climate crisis. And I also don't disagree with you at all that like capitalism is a dead system that has been advanced to a point where it's like whatever about it was maybe working, it has long since stopped working and has been dead and rotting for a while now and needs to be, if not entirely destroyed, needs to be massively excavated and reworked. Is that, first of all, is that an accurate sort of description, would you think, of what you were saying to me in response of like saying, I think this needs to be completely dismantled before we can even talk about what the rebuild looks like?
My political views definitely, and I agree that 100% capitalism is a dead system. I do, and I know that this gets me in hot water with my audience even, of me saying that I actually kind of disagreed with Karl Marx on this one, that I don't think that capitalism had that many beneficial things from the start. I think that it definitely, I agree more with like the side of capitalism eventually leads and is heavily intertwined with colonialism and imperialism, and that you can't really get rid of all of that.
Agreed.
And untangle that mess. And so for me, I think that even the benefits in terms of innovation that a lot of people credit to capitalism, I personally, and maybe this is just the anthropologist in me, so I think about like things on a much longer time scale normally, because that's what I studied in college. But when I look at capitalism and just the amount of planet destruction that it has done in the short amount of time that it's been around, as well as just rising inequality in regards to relatively how much extreme wealth we are creating on this tiny little planet and how much it is held in very few hands. I think that all of that to me makes it disagree with Karl Marx that like maybe it wasn't necessary as a stepping stone. I also disagree with the idea that like history is in fact linear, but that's a separate thing. But overall, I do agree with you that capitalism, regardless of if it was ever been beneficial, has run its course. And now we are at this crossroads seemingly where it's, do we continue chugging on slightly where we are now and work within what we have, or do we try and completely dismantle it and do something else? And obviously it comes down to the question that people are always talking about of like, can you dismantle the master's house with the master's tools? And to me, I think that politically I lean more towards no than I do yes. However, and I don't know if it's maybe just that event that like not too long ago, like a few years ago, I was more progressive than I am right now, communist. I think maybe it's that I hold on to those parts of me a little bit, but I do think that a part of me still understands that. And as I said in my video, and that I think that you would agree with, is that you want to minimize the harm to as many people as possible, regardless of whatever path you choose. You need to think about the most vulnerable, which means that you don't just drop everything, like throw out the baby with the bathwater. You've got to protect the people who are reliant on our current systems. And that's when then I fall back on like, reform is not the path forward to a good future, but it is, in my opinion, one of the better steps that we are in the position of taking right now. I don't know if that's
excellent answer. I really like that adage about you can't dismantle or can you dismantle the master's house with the master's tools. What does that mean to you when that comes up in conversation? Like, what does that mean in the context of this conversation about dismantling this system?
I think that to me, it implies that if we keep some amount, like we look oftentimes to the successes of the Nordic countries of like social democracies and where we have more of a, honestly, just a better safety net than we've ever seen in the United States, so that when people fall from this very cutthroat individualistic system called capitalism, that when they eventually fall, because people are bound to, that there's a nice, cushy public safety net that can catch them. And my issue with that is that capitalism, because the only thing that it gears itself towards will always be profits, in my mind, that means that they will always be stripping that safety net. So no matter if in the system of the master's house, no matter if you keep on trying to build something new within the master's house walls, the master will just come in my mind and just beat it and crush it. And then you have to start all over, versus if you start from scratch, then you actually have a chance of it continuing and not being a continuous fight as much, and so that then it can truly progress rather than us seemingly, as we're seeing in the United States, fight to just not go backwards. We're not even talking about moving forward. We're just like, could we please at least just keep women's rights or like something of the sort? And they're like, no. So that's kind of where I see it.
Awesome. I'm looking over my outline here and I'm realizing that I sort of wrote it like in a weird order. So I'm going to sort of just shift up the order here, but like, I think this just keeps us in the line of thought we're currently on, talking about this specifically. And then we can move on to another topic. Let's say that we were able to fully dismantle capitalism sometime in like the next 10 to 20 years. And again, you know, because we're monitoring this ticking clock, this impending immediate crisis of the climate, you know.
Even there, crisis, meet doom.
Yes, doom. No, yeah, exactly. Yeah, this impending doom. Let's say that we are able to like mobilize in a way that that does deal with the fact that, that this dead system needs to be dismantled and taken down. Do you have, and you're not required to, you're just a person who's like trying to advocate for these ideas. I think sometimes when I'm advocating for like an idea or a direction that I would like to see things moving, and people are like, well, can you explain to me how that works? Step, walk me all the way through.
Yeah. I want 1 through 10 steps to get me there. And I'm like,
I'm not necessarily like, I don't know that I'm the person. Maybe there are people who are more well-equipped to answer that question. I just know that like, I like the idea of the destination, but maybe we could have a conversation. Have you ever thought about what the process of that might look like, what those steps could look like, and how a process like that could protect the most vulnerable amongst us and the marginalized? Because I look at that process, and the first thing that I think is Alex Garland's movie Civil War that's coming out this year. Like, that's the first thing I think is that it's just like, it just gets messy real fast, and it looks like mass bloodshed, and like it just like things get way worse before they have a chance of getting better. Is there a world in which you can see a system this big and this pervasive and this powerful being dismantled that doesn't look like that? Or is that sort of, Am I right in going to that space?
So I do want to preface, and now I like that we started with our cute little getting to know each other. I'm just turning my phone on airplane mode. I don't know if you guys heard that buzz. But I like the fact that we started at me being French, because I do think that that does definitely impact my political views. Like, I won't lie, that I do think that just growing up around with my mother being very French and just her teaching, like, we speak French at home, and we would go visit her family in France. It's very like, rah, rah, the revolution. Like, it was never wrong. There were never any issues, even though they had to do it like 5 different times. They're like, we're good. Like, this is what we do best. And so I do think that that obviously for me, given the, I will use the word that it probably is accurate for what I experienced as a French child, but the propaganda that the French would talk about their past with revolutions definitely impact my political views today. However, with that said, I love Les Misérables. I've seen it so many times, so I'm not dumb in that I know, because that's where I get all my historical information, but I'm not dumb in knowing that like it is obviously something that is scary. It is unstable and it is terrifying. Like, it just is all of those things, and it is violent. And so for me, that's when then I fall back on, I have thought about the steps as much as like I, as me, can as one individual. And to me, it's the steps forward very much must involve diversity of tactics. And what I mean by that is that there are some people who are going to be on the complete like French Revolution side of like, let's be the ones with the pitchforks. Let's be the ones training in that way. And as much as I think that there is a sect of society that attracts, sure, fine, cool. If I personally, I'm chronically ill, that's unfortunately not me.
you're not trying to be a soldier anytime soon.
Nope. I just do not have those skills. And I have to be honest with myself that I don't have those skills. And so therefore, I think that also what impacts my politics, and I wonder if you agree with this, is that I feel myself hesitant to ask for people to put themselves in a situation that I realistically could not put myself in without it seeming very bad or dangerous. And so it's hard for me to be like, oh yeah, everyone should go, just because I'm chronically ill, everyone should go do that. Because if I can't do it, then it's hard for me to advocate for something like that. One, before I continue, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. But I would even take it further and say like, I mean, like, do I have to be like precluded by some sort of physical ailment to say, I just don't actually want to be like involved in a like throat slitting gun shooting war with other, I don't actually want to be on the front lines of like a war. I want to see if there's a way I can participate in this that doesn't involve me having to pick up a gun and stand a post. Like and I don't have necessarily like a chronic illness that precludes me from that. And I wonder if that there's room for that. If there's room for people who are like, I want to participate in dismantling a system that is actively, you know, contributing to the doom of humanity. And is there a way to participate in that or is that no, you're a fucking coward.
and that's where I completely agree with you, because as someone who like my sister, she trained in martial arts her whole entire life. And, you know, I was given the opportunity and every single time I said no, even before I was chronically ill, because that's just not who I am. I mean, for fuck's sake, I want to go to med school. Like, I am the person who wants to do the helping, not exactly the hurting. And so when it comes to my gut instinct towards that part of communist ideology, honestly, I will say that like it does, I still have that regular, like, honestly, I would consider it people would probably call me that a lib reaction, or just, I just think that it's just a natural knee jerk reaction. And so, sorry, just the comments are so distracting, but they're so exciting when I see them. And so while I do see that side, I do think that with a diversity of tactics, it has room for all of the above. So there are people, and that's the part that's so beautiful about diversity of tactics, is that just because someone else is doing something that you don't necessarily fully agree with, you can point out your criticism, similar to what I think I was trying to do with your bus video. But you can still, at the end, like I said in that video, still ultimately agree on certain things. And so for me, a part of what I really worry about with that type of mindset of where we are talking about more French style, that's what we'll call it. I do think that is just inherently, it leads to a lot of ableist culture. It just does. It always does. And it is always the most vulnerable who are on the front lines. And it always hurts the most vulnerable. Like, again, if you need any clarity and you love music, Les Misérables is a perfect film for you, or the Broadway version is really good, so I hear. So like, that's one side. But then the other side is mutual aid and divesting from our current systems. And that, I think, is where, to me, that is so much more important than the last option, which is more reformism. Because reformism, I do think that it has its place, specifically with regards to dulling the edges of this very sharp, dangerous system to try and make it more manageable and more of like, if I want, like, similar to what I say oftentimes and what I said a year ago, and now I feel kind of gross saying it, but I will nevertheless. But when you have to pick between your enemies, I would much rather, and I think that you would agree with this, I would much rather pick the enemy that doesn't believe that we should just have semi-automatics randomly on the street, because if I'm not the person to buy that semi-automatic weapon, then like, and I'm coming up against a Republican who does and who has no issue with harming my person, I would much rather that day have been fighting a liberal who has one of those shitty little signs in their lawn that says love is love. Like, I would much rather be fighting them than that. Not saying that I would want to fight at all, but that's
what I'm saying. I don't want to be like fighting those guys.
Like, I don't want to have to get to that point. And I think that that's when I lean more towards, when I look at mutual aid and divesting, I'm very much of the mindset that the Black Panthers had a really good idea. Now, definitely there were lessons to be learned, specifically with regards to how they were maintaining the organization, and especially with being armed, and how that then led to it being a more dangerous word for people to get involved with. And I think that separation between that side of the org with other mutual aid aspects could be a lesson to be learned. However, they had a really good system going specifically for getting like ambulances in their district and specifically for like food programs for children. And I think that through those mutual aid organizing, I know that this is a really long answer, but through those, then we could divest from our current systems. And by divesting from our current systems, one, it makes dismantling those systems a lot less harmful to the vulnerable communities because they now have an alternative to go to for their clinics, for like for healthcare, for food, for all of those essentials that we know people will need in unstable times. But also, I think that then it leaves the last option, which is the least important, which is, again, reform. And the one in between organizing and reform is unions. And so that's kind of how I see the way forward. And now, obviously, I don't have all the answers for like the steps, but I can say that in my mind, we're going to get a lot further, a lot faster by focusing on that middle one where it's more inclusive than the far one. And so it's more so like if you can cook, then guess what? You can show up to a mutual aid event and do food, not bombs. If you have some sort of artistic skill, you can donate that to whatever org to help them build their platform. Like there are so many smaller ways that are less dangerous that organize and divest from our current systems that I think will get us further than reform.
That's excellent. And it also plays really well into something I want to talk about later. So there's like, this will come back up, this like diversity of tactics and like this diversity of like uses for different people and different skill sets. And so that's really good. I think this will reemerge. I also just want to say that I love a podcast guest who can give long, detailed answers because the less time that I need to spend yapping, the better for me as a host. Like I hate when I listen back to an episode where I have a guest on and I'm like, Austin, shut up. That let the guest talk now. So I love it when I have a guest that I'm like, oh no, please. Let me ask you a question and then go, please. I love that. If nothing other than it helps my ego feel like, look how good you did at listening today, Austin. Look how.
Also good questions. You can pat yourself in the back for that too.
Okay. That was a really, really good examination of, kind of a probably abstract breakdown of like an approach to what dismantling could look like and what full on dismantling versus reformism and those things. Let's say, since the title of the episode is The Future, let's say that we're there. We've successfully, through whatever process of multiple tactics, we have successfully dismantled. We are now in the era, the space of like, the clay is now ready to be molded into something new. We have raw materials with which to build. What do you have an idea of what a process like that could look like and what it is that we're trying to build? So like hoping to paint a picture for the listener who goes like, well, what else is it? Because this is all I've ever known. I've only ever known these chains and these streets and these rules. What does it look like? And how can I envision myself in that? Could you give us maybe?
Definitely. I've thought about this too. Also, especially because I draw. So this has definitely like to literally imagine what a different alternative would look like. And I would like to start with the big one, which would be public transportation. Mm-hmm. That would be something. And that's also part of my reasoning for why I don't think that even in dismantling it, I don't end up leaning as much as I do still have some similar mindsets to like anarchist beliefs. I do lean more communist because to me, I believe that there are certain projects, certain human rights that are better and can be done more effectively at a larger scale. Infrastructure being one, healthcare being another, education being another that I think is also pretty good if we standardize at least some of it, not that we need to have the state tip like side of education that we currently have, but definitely like those. And so when I look at it, I believe that one step first, like, that, well, I guess at this point, Citizens United would be gone because that is essential for not falling back into the old ways. And I think that that's going to be a part of rebuilding is putting those roadblocks to make sure that we don't go backwards. And so I do think that at some point, like wealth redistribution would have to be done some way, somehow. We just cannot have such a small percent of the population holding so much wealth and so much power in their hands, because inherently, no matter what democracy we try to create, it just will be swayed by the amount of resources that they have. So wealth redistribution is one part of it. The next part of it would be rebuilding democracy at both worker levels. So if you are at your workplace, you would automatically have a say, not saying that you would have to attend. It'd be very similar to how we vote now. If you don't want to vote, you don't have to. No one's going to show up at your door and force you to. Similar at the workplace of you would have a right to vote in the policies of your workplace, but it would not be forced upon you. So that would also avoid some of the power grabs that happen. And that it would also be forced mandatory time to do the voting. So that similar to now that we have the issue with gerrymandering and people not being able to take time off work. So we would get rid of that. Then you'd also have more democracy at the local levels. So you would have similar to now with state governments, but you'd have more council-based rather than representatives. And so it's like a slight difference between just how quickly you can call them back and also what power they have. And also you would have to have balances within the community. So if there's a more marginalized part of the community, they would have to have some sort of balance measure so that their resources aren't just exploited. So that would be at the local level. And then at the national level, you would have, in my mind, first of all, you can't have any capitalist business models. So there's no way you could start a business and that you would be one person at the top or a board and an unelected person or an unelected board dictating for everyone else. Capitalist business would not exist. So what would be replaced is that worker democracy. But then on the federal level, it would be still democratically run, but it would have to be only workers. So now that we've done the wealth distribution, if you are not a worker, unless you obviously have a disability or something that makes you not work, you can't partake in government. So you would also get a more similar to worker salary. It would not be some like, oh, now I can be Nancy Pelosi and invest in all of these microchips right before we pass a law that helps with microchips. So that would be that prevention to stop us also from slipping backwards. But the federal government, because of its size, would also have the ability to seize major companies that were capitalists to force them into either the public sphere. So similar to us having nationalized healthcare, similar to what they do in the UK, we could nationalize that, or we could seize if there is a farm production group that is, or even a really good one would be Amazon, because then we could just have all the distribution information that they already have. But if we seize those companies and then force them to become worker owned or operated, slash if you get to a big enough size and you become publicly owned and you get switched over into the public side, I think that that's the way that I see it forward. I don't know if that was a good description.
No, that was great. It's like I'm literally like daydreaming. I'm like over here going like, oh God, you know, it sounds actually really, really cool and really, really nice. But also I'm sitting over here going like, maybe I'm just too much of an idealist and maybe I'm being kind of naive and not realistic here. But when I listen to you saying that, I'm like, oh, this really does sound like something that we could like incrementally work toward in a reformist way. Like this really does seem like something that like within the system that we have that we could bit by bit start to implement the policies that lean toward this philosophy. But then the question of the ticking clock of the climate crisis comes into play. And it's like, do you have the time to slowly try to shift the cultural lens to this over time more and more and more bit by bit? Or will you run out of time? Will Mother Nature decide for you and pull the rug out?
I also think that the other thing that keeps me from being an incrementalist is not only climate change, but is also, again, I'm from Georgia, so seeing their reaction in Cop City has been really eye-opening for me personally to see the extent to which our opposition, i.e. the more openly fascist group, how willing they are to roll everything back. I mean, we've been seeing it with the child labor laws. We've been seeing it with so many different things of just, it seems like it, like we were like, I thought that we figured this out, like gay rights, so many things. I was like, I thought that we figured this out and then we were in agreement. And now we're having to go backwards and refight those. And that's where I think that capitalism, as much as it will accept some reform, it will fundamentally always favor profits over people. So it will always fight that reform tooth and nail, and it will also successfully do so because it holds the resources, because for the past 100 years it's been building up and accumulating these resources, i.e. the profits. So that's where, to me, it's not that, if you had asked me in a different time, maybe I could have been more incrementalist. And I think that was honestly part of the reason why my politics were more incrementalist when I was younger. Not saying that that's like a young thing or anything, but just that for me personally, when I was younger, I did definitely feel like I had more time. Like I felt like the clock wasn't ticking as fast as it is now. And so for me, I think that that's what's changed it.
That's also a pretty good, honestly, working refutation of the main argument that I was making in my original bus video, which is like, it all hinges on this idea of like, far right religious authoritarian extremists actually have mainstream political power in the United States. They actually are very close to accomplishing the goals that they want. And they regularly do accomplish their goals. Like they actually get to do the things that they want to do. Whereas like far left, we never get to implement jack shit. Like we don't even get to like whiff the things that we're trying to implement, you know? So, and my argument there was to be like, well, then you're a person who subscribes to a philosophy that does not have mainstream political weight or representation, you have no choice but to vote in a way that just deprives the far right fundamentalist extremists from obtaining even more power, because that's the reality you have to contend with. But also like the fact that they have mainstream power also poses a very real ticking clock, that it's like they're moments away from doing their thing. And you know, every time there's an election up, like they're moments away from like really doing the thing that they want to do. And can you combat that with an incrementalist philosophy or mindset? So, and I don't know. So I have a question also
for you. Do you think, based on that, do you think that how much do you think Biden and Trump actually agree on? Like, ballpark, like policies, more importantly, what Biden has been pushed to believe, not necessarily what he believes in his heart of hearts, because I don't know if he even knows. So
who knows what either one of them actually believe in their heart of hearts?
That is also, true.
I don't know.
In terms of the overlap.
Oh God. You know, I do believe that they are both fundamentally people who are going to work to uphold capitalist structure and who are not going to be working hard to dismantle things that are contributing to the rot of late stage capitalism. You know, like I don't, even with like infrastructure bills and things like that, I don't see a lot of like addressing the fact that it's like, hey, we used to have checks and balances governmentally put in place that were specifically meant to monitor the fact that like capitalism is a ticking time bomb of a system and of a philosophy. Like there seemed to be an acknowledgement early on that it was like, hey, this system inherently has built into it this like massive incentive to grow your wealth exorbitantly. So we need to have things in place to like monitor for the human instinct toward greed. And it seems like everything post Reagan era has spurned on the like accelerated death of the system, because it's just like Reagan ushered in an era of politics where it was like, what if we just didn't have any of those checks and balances or regulations? What if we actually just let people's greed run fully rampant? And I don't actually see really any mainstream political power in America today doing anywhere near enough to combat that. Being like the closest that you get is someone like Bernie Sanders, who will at least like talk about it, who will at least be like, hey, like you guys, like this is not how it was supposed to be, you know? I definitely don't see Joe Biden trying to implement policy that even like nudges the ship in that direction. I do think that he's better at like course maintaining than what you get with a Donald Trump, which is Trump's more interested in just like personal dominance and power than he is.
He's gonna be a dictator, just for one day. Awesome. Yeah, it's just like, one day.
I don't think that the Biden-Harris administration is as interested in like dynastic philosophy of like we want to instill.
None. Otherwise, they wouldn't have run with him.
which that's maybe the biggest mystery of all, honestly, Leah, for me in the current political quagmire and dilemma that we find ourselves in, is just that it's like I just don't fully understand what the Democratic, the DNC is up to. Like I didn't understand it in 2020, and I remember when everyone was like, he'll be a one-term president, and I was like, but no, he won't. Even then I was like, what are you guys talking about? Like there's anything that our two mainstream political institutions hate more than anything else, it's shifting away from like what is normal and what is expected. Yeah. Like they hate unprecedented moves.
And they like incumbents.
Yeah, and a one-term president is a precedent that neither party is ready to like try to introduce into the system. But that's why it never made sense to me from the get-go. I just was like, you really can't think of another person that would be a better option than this guy. And at the time, in like 2018, 2019, I was going around going, no one that I talk to, nobody that I know, none of my friends, none of my family members, nobody that I know is a Joe Biden guy. Like, I know people who are Elizabeth Warren people. I know people who are like Pete Buttigieg. I knew Andrew Yang people. I knew Bernie Sanders people. I knew people who aligned at all these different places. I didn't know anybody who was a Joe Biden guy. But the news was telling me this is who is the most popular candidate on the left. And now there's a few different options there of like you can get conspiratorial and go, oh, this is the DNC pulling puppet strings. I think I'm drifting away from the question you asked, but it's because I want to steer us into...
No, you're totally good.
I want to steer us into this topic too of like, you talked about early on that like anything left of center or neoliberal we're sort of a rat's nest of not being able to like agree on strategy anything. And stuff like, yeah. And I think that in this post October 7th world where I'm doing a lot of effusive discussion with people who I am more or less philosophically or ideologically aligned with, and I'm having more debates with people on the left than I am with people on the right, I'm starting to gain an appreciation and a respect for the reality of just how big tent ideologically and philosophically the left is and what a problem that poses. And that maybe, like, I think that we see a lot of people on the left who... we surround ourselves with people who think the same way that we do, and we think that that is what the left is, and the left is just so much bigger than that. It's like when you look at the numbers in an election and it's like 75 million people, it's like there might be like 3 or 4 million of those people who have the same political ideology as you specifically. Yeah. But you know, maybe that many, but and you might be friends with a lot of those people or have a lot of those people in your social circle. All of this is to say is like that might be what the DNC is actually up to, is like who is a candidate that can viably work for a voting base that is this demographically diverse.
But like, even then, I still think that Joe Biden isn't your guy.
Yeah, I know. It still is like,
my follow-up question is, do you fall more in the camp of there in my circles, there are like two different opinions or trains of thought, which is, some think that the Democrats are just incompetent because they're either one behind the times, so they don't really understand how much has changed with the Trump presidency. And so they're incompetent in that way. But then there's also people who believe that they're deliberately incompetent, in that it is because they have so much more popularity when in direct opposition with the current status quo of the right. And so that they purposefully don't push to do the best that could put them leagues ahead of like be an FDR president, because ultimately that would, one, mean not siding with capital, which funds all their campaigns, but two, because then it gives them to be like, at least we're better than them. And it's like, okay, but when you were in power, how much different were you? And I think that that's where I wonder your thoughts. Do you think that it's more like a deliberate incompetence, or do you think that it's more of a, they're just fumbling the bag?
I'll be completely honest with you, and my answer is going to be pretty unsatisfying. I genuinely don't know. Like, I think that all of these ideas and these, like, when I hear someone explain, like, I think it's this, I'm like, that, yeah, sure, that's totally viable. Like, that, like, their number one goal is what keeps us employed, what keeps the system churning the way that it's meant to churn, because that's the thing that keeps us employed. And if that means we always got to keep the race close, we've always got to have something to push against, because that keeps us sort of like, you got to vote for us or else they're going to do this thing. I can totally buy into that. But I can also buy into the idea that it's just like they're just out of touch and they don't know what the fuck they're doing. I can also buy into the idea that it's just like it's really hard to organize
anything,
a party for a voting base that's this demographically diverse and ideologically diverse. Whereas like the right gets the benefit of just being like overwhelmingly the demographic that we're appealing to are white Christian people, you know, and we have that benefit of having a smaller ideological base to have to cater to. I can see it being any number of things. The real answer is that I'm like, I don't actually fully understand what makes powerful people do the things that they do, because I've never really understood why no billionaire just like steps in and just is like, hey, you know what? I'm going to buy up enough real estate in different urban areas across the United States, and I'm going to house the unhoused. And I own this property, and I get to do that. It's mine, and I don't owe anybody any money on it. I own it, and they get to live there. And I'm like, we would erect statues in your name. Like, you would go down in history as, like, one of the greatest human beings who ever lived. Like, the Mormon church that I was raised in has $150 billion stockpiled, and I'm like, you guys could run, like, the world would bow down to Mormonism if you just stepped in and you're like, we're gonna use 50 billion of our $100 billion to just sort of like fix the housing crisis, and we're just going to like fix this overnight. It's like the world would be like, the Mormons saved humanity. Like, and the fact that they don't do that is just a thing that I can't wrap my brain around. So when you ask me like, what are they up to, I'm like, I don't know what powerful people are thinking. And all I can really come back to is like, there must just be some kind of poison in wealth and in greed that like that just ruins people's abilities to reason properly. And I can almost see it myself. It's like, I started making more money a few years ago than I'd ever made in my life. And instantly I felt this thing of like, this instant like virus comes into your brain of like, how could you make more? How can you retain more of that? What's the least amount of taxes you can pay on that? What is the way that you can retain the most of that wealth pot? How can you maximize that wealth? And it's like, does it all just come down to that?
But then I wonder, because then the libertarians would be like, well, that's just human nature, you know, like that's just human nature to be inherently greedy, and just some of us aren't in a privileged enough position to act on it. Mm-hmm. But that's where then I kind of think about that, the quote of like, if I saw a monkey, not a monkey, if I saw an elephant in a circus, then I would think that that's how it acted rather than actually in its natural habitat. And that's when the anthropologist part in me is like, when I look at these billionaires who are doing this, who refuse to do it, to me, it's just the filtering process of who becomes the billionaire. I mean, there's that one billionaire, I forget his name, but he did. Specifically, he was like, I am accumulating more wealth than I will ever need. So I, by the time I die, I need all my wealth to be gone. I need it all to be donated to some sort of nonprofit. I need it to all be gone doing good things. It was taking years and years and years for them to get rid of it, because it just accumulates faster for this 0.1% than they could ever get rid of. And so it's one of those things where it's like, even for the best hearted, they're in that position where it's like, one, the best hearted oftentimes don't make it that far up the ladder because it involves climbing on so many other people. But two, by the time that they get to the top, the numbers itself just continue creating more wealth than they could ever possibly get rid of. And so I think that then that in their mind, that maybe justifies just continuing the status quo. And I also do just then wonder, like, it's not that I look at the Democrats, because I don't know where I fall on that. I don't know if they are fumbling it on purpose. Sometimes I just agree with you. I look at them and I'm like, FDR literally has been voted on numerous occasions to be the best president ever. The way that he did it was by not giving a single fuck. He was saying that I will pack the courts. If you oppose me, I will pack the courts. What are you going to do? I have the army. You don't. He did all of those things by ignoring decorum, by pushing for what the party wanted. Well, not even what the party, but what the people wanted, even when that wasn't exactly what he believed in. I mean, he wasn't a diehard socialist. Like, he wasn't out there being like, Social Security is necessary because we need to get the means of production under control. Like, no, like he was someone who very much just saw the writing on the wall, which is, if I don't play ball with this large percentage of the population that want these policies, I will not get reelected. I will not have political success. And I look at the Democrats and I'm like, it's the same thing and you're not doing it. And so that's why then to me, I fall back on, and I think that that's what also impacts my views of, will neoliberalism and therefore liberals, therefore just mainstream Democrats, always capitulate to capital and always bow down to it, regardless of how bad it is for the rest of the people, because ultimately the people aren't who they care about. They've shown us a long time ago that they don't actually care about what their voters think, because they keep on pushing these candidates that are ungodly unpopular on us. And so rather than trying to change course, they stick with the status quo. And I can't help but sit here and be like, if nothing else, they know that it is self-serving. They know that it also puts a lot more vulnerable people in danger. And so in my mind, I'm like, what alternative reasoning is there other than they are just stupid? Which to me is kind of what I try to avoid as much as possible, of just like, you're just stupid. Yeah. So to me, it's like, it must be kind of what you're saying, of this power of this profit corrupts, which is why, then to circle back to why I don't believe in reformism, is that I just think that the profit incentive is the embodiment of greed for humans. So to build any amount of systems around it is bound to create inequality, because it just is something that revolves around, I have something that you don't, rather than, let's all be in a society that shares what we need.
Yes. You know, there's another possibility here, and this is, I'm going to pivot us into our final topic that I want to talk about, which is like, we'll see how deep we can get into this one, because it's a whole other thing that we could probably spend an hour to an hour and a half talking about. But there's another thing here, which is like, when we look at a candidate that's being put in front of us that seems to be so unpopular, and when we look at a situation like what's currently happening in this election year, where we're going, how could you possibly not be taking a stronger stance against Israel when this is like, it's gonna kill your election? And it seems like that to us. It seems like in the circles that we run in and in the spaces that we occupy online, it seems clear that it's sort of like Trump with COVID in 2020. It's like, if you could have managed that like in a halfway decent way, you might have skated across the, you might have been fine, but you like fumbled that so hard in an election year, and it really like, it really killed your chances of being reelected. And that's sort of what feels like is happening right now. There's this other possibility of like, maybe they just feel like the position that a lot of us have on the far left of wanting them to take a decidedly more firm stance in pushing for a workable ceasefire, maybe they actually feel like that's not as popular of a position as we think it is. That maybe they're like, yeah, we understand that we're going to lose like potentially like 1 million or 2 million of the votes that we had in 2020, that those people will never come back, but we think we can still win in the Electoral College without those votes. We, you know, like maybe it's not as popular of a position
so
as
I
we
wonder-
think it is.
And I'm about to make an argument that I usually don't. I tend to avoid because I do feel icky. And it was in my notes. But I wonder your thoughts in response to that. Is accelerationism is pushed a lot in my circles, where people are like, actually, it would be better if you want to dismantle capitalism by completely stepping away from the bourgeoisie politics of Democrat versus Republican and just let the Republicans annihilate the Democrats, because they will do that. And then people will be radicalized to how bad capitalism and how bad the status quo actually is for their own personal interest. Well, I don't disagree with that. I personally think that that relies a lot on making people's lives worse, which to me, in my experience, means that less people would have time to organize. More people would be fighting for their everyday survival rather than actually being like, I can go to this community meeting, or I can go harass my local governor. Instead, they're like worried for if they're going to be put in a new prison cell that is getting funded by Cop City people and stuff like that. So like, on one end, I see that. However, the part of accelerationism that I can't disagree with, because that part I fundamentally disagree with, because it puts the most vulnerable people at increased risk, which to me, I just, until we have alternative networks of mutual aid built, if we had those, I could be more for an accelerationist argument, because then it's we're showing them how bad that system is, but they have an alternative. So they have someone to catch them. I just cannot think that giving them nothing and then being like, now go build that alternative is a good idea. I just don't think that we're there. Like, if we can't get people to boycott Starbucks, we're not going to get people while they're fighting for their life to now build a socialist utopia separate from capitalism. I just don't think that that's possible.
100%.
So yeah, that I agree with. However, the part that I do think is fascinating is specifically with Democratic strategy. And I look at the border crisis, where I look at, honestly, their stance on abortion, many of those things. When you look at when a Republican is in power, the language that Democrats use to describe the actions that we all know they themselves, if they were in power, would continue to do, because they have, similar with the border, similar with Biden being like, I'll continue building your wall, even though he was saying, well, kids are in cages. He kept the kids in cages. But when kids are in cages under Republicans, they use language that mobilize these, the people that you're describing, because I do agree with you. We are in a smaller, as much as I do think that a lot of people are waking up to being pro-Palestine, especially in the younger groups, it is just fundamentally correct. And I will not forget it because my parents are both boomers, that there are still a lot of those people around that outnumber us. And so I agree with you there. However, when Democrats actually are in a position to oppose Republicans, that's when they heighten their language that then, in my opinion, convinces those liberals to have the position that I wanted them to have, i.e. like kids in cages bad, because they're willing to say that because Trump is the one doing it. And so I wonder if, and again, this would be a long-term strategy where then I circle back to, I don't think that we have time for long-term strategies. But then that leaves out me, I don't know what strategy we have time for. But do you think that in an alternative world, when Trump becomes president, all of a sudden Democrats are a lot more willing to say it is a genocide, to say the words Israel is a Zionist apartheid state? Do you think that that is likely? Because that is
that's a really interesting point. That's really interesting that, like, to get them to say it, it would need to be because Donald Trump is allowing it to happen. And if Donald Trump is allowing it to happen, then they can, you know, it's a really interesting point. Oh, God.
But even then, that's the thing. It's like, it still wouldn't materially, even when I do think that through and I do think that it's a good point, I'm still like, Palestinian lives would still be lost. But right now, it just seems like no matter what we do, this will continue. So I just.
Yeah, I mean, God, you know what's so frustrating about this conversation is like, this is the work that we both like immerse ourselves in and are trying to find a way to like to strategize on. But the problem keeps coming up with like the pressure of the timeline, because there are all these aspects that make the timeline feel like, because it's like, well, all this stuff, everything that you talked about in what the future could look like in more democratic workspaces and getting rid of capitalistic business models and all these things, all of that stuff sounds amazing, but it also is something where I'm like, this would have to be carefully cultivated into the culture. People would have to like see the messaging would have to be there. People would have to be allowed to engage with this kind of philosophy in social media and these different, you know, and meetings and things like this with, and this would have to be carefully cultivated over time. And it really feels like the safest approach is incrementalism. And then you introduce the imminent threat of far-right extremism and authoritarianism, fascism. You introduce the imminent threat of the climate crisis. You introduce the imminent threat of, you know, war around the world and the immediate need for attention on the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. And it feels like we no longer have time for safe incrementalism. And then you have this sort of paradoxical thing between, can I still afford to try to use this multifaceted, multi-approach thing, or do I just need to start picking up a sledgehammer and being a little bit more reckless and just being like, sorry, there's no time and people are going to get hurt, but we, you know, and like, and that's where, so that's where I come into this last thing, which is, again, like I keep, I'm funneling it here because I do think that we are actually naturally arriving at this, which is another big thing that I keep hearing in the messaging in my spaces, and I think that you've probably heard this too. And this is why, like, a lot of my online discourse or discussion around Palestine and Gaza is about the way that we're talking and the way that we in the West are like messaging and how we are advocating, more so than just sort of like advocating. And that's probably something that I could be justifiably criticized for, that people are like, stop getting focused on how we're talking and just fucking talk about it. And I'm like, yeah, definitely. But I also think it matters how we talk about it. And I think that it matters, like, does the way that we talk about it invite people to participate, or does it discourage participation? And there are tactics and methodologies that I worry are discouraging participation. And one of those is this sort of philosophy of like, your advocacy is all or nothing. You are either giving yourself fully to this and you are all in, or your advocacy is worthless. Like, if you are just the sort of person who posts on your Instagram story once a week about this, that's equivalent to zero. And it's also equivalent to, like, you might as well be in the IDF. Like, fuck you. You know, like, it feels so, a lot of what I see sort of has this, like, underbelly of aggression. And I understand and sympathize with where the root of the aggression, that it's like, I genuinely don't know if I've witnessed a humanitarian crisis on this level in my lifetime that's so publicly broadcast and so, like, visible. So I understand, like, how that elicits strong emotion from people that feels like, if you don't care about this as much as I care about this, then you're a bad person. You just are. But sometimes that messaging, I think, creates an environment where it's discouraging for people to want to participate and want to get involved rather than welcoming. What are your thoughts on that?
I 100% agree. Actually, I just want to give a quick anecdote about this because I think that it's pertinent. I go every week, two times a week, to the bridge in my tiny town. And I just hold signs that just say very basic things that should not anger anyone. Like, even one of the signs says something along the lines of, like, and that's not the sign that I hold. Not that I disagree with the sign, but to tell you how, like, nice it is of, like, ceasefire now or stop U.S. government complicity in mass annihilation. Like, nothing like Israel should not exist. Like, that we're not, that's not, as much as I think that there the solution is one state and that state being Palestine with equal rights for all and it's a democracy, as much as I believe that, my sign does not say that. And so it's literally, we're not saying anything. We just stand on this bridge where there's a lot of traffic for an hour twice a week and just remind people that it's happening. Like, truly, just because we understand that there are a lot of people, especially in my tiny town, who are older, who don't necessarily have social media. So just to remind them that it is happening. A new person decided to join us because it's free to join with everyone. And as much as I appreciate this person, I really do. I don't know their pronouns, so I'm going to go by they, them, but they have a lot of great energy. And you can clearly tell when they showed up, of like, when they first showed up, I was the first person on the bridge that they crossed and they started chanting really loudly, Free Palestine. And I was like, love the energy. But here's the thing. We are invading as much as we are just on the street. This is not one of those protests where it is a mass group of people. So we are trying to, like, get loud. We're trying to make our voices heard. This is just a subtle reminder. And also just for these people on the bridge to build some sort of community around this. And then she went and she grabbed a sign, and they started chanting nonstop the entire time that they were on the bridge. And so naturally on this bridge, there's a stoplight. And so these people are stopping. And rather than just reading the sign, this person is chanting very loudly at them. And again, I don't think that that's the worst that could be done. I think that the time is, like, again, the emotions, I agree with you completely. It is so justified to be that angry. But on the flip end, that's where then the strategic part in me is like, but will that invite more people to come to the bridge? It would be a lot more powerful to be on this bridge with more signs than with a few more people chanting. It would be a lot more powerful to also have it be more welcoming where they could come and talk.
Yeah, I'll just be honest. Like, in my lifetime, I feel like there have been causes that I have been called to go and participate and demonstrate and march and hold signs with, where, like, I felt like the environment emanated love, like a Black Lives Matter march or protest in the wake of, like, something horrific that we all watched, that we're all like, yeah, we all just watched, like, a really fucked up thing happen. And now we're all going to organize and march about this thing that still keeps happening, this epidemic of, like, police brutality and violence. But, like, the space when you enter it feels like it's emanating good vibes. And it's like, it feels so tone policey to be like, hey, when you're telling people not to do genocide, can you be nice about it? Like, it feels so...
Because it feels so silly. And so, especially in comparison to the cause, it feels just inappropriate. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the cause, as much as I wish that it were just a humanitarian thing, because it should be calling on everyone's humanity, it is inherently political. And so for politics, as much as I hate playing the game of politics within reformism, and that's why I'm not going to crap on it all the time. Sometimes I will. But most of the time what I'm advocating for is you do both. You go show up, you may vote for whatever your morals are calling for. If you feel as if you just cannot stomach another vote for Joe Biden, then I support the diversity of tactics with supporting an alternative candidate. If you feel like we need to keep Trump out at all costs, whatever. But my point is that I do think that because it is inherently political, we have to think about a strategy that will get the most people on board and the most people to stay involved and to do so sustainably. And that's where the black or white thinking of what you're talking about, of people dogpiling on someone because their activism isn't good enough for you. I mean, like, not to use this sad and awful example, but like, if Aaron Bushnell expected everyone to do his extreme act of protest, we would have no one left for the movement. And that's not to discredit that form of extreme act of protest, but I think he himself was even very much aware that it's not supposed to be a rallying cry for people to copy. It's supposed to be just a wake-up call, a very tragic, I wish it was unnecessary. I can't even get myself to say that it was unnecessary, but it was his decision and I can respect that. But like, we can't all be that principled, because ultimately it gets us in danger.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is sort of the basis of what's brought up this thought for me. Is like, I've been ingesting a lot of all or nothing sort of like dogmatic, like, hey, it's, if you're not doing this at, and usually what people, when people say that, I think like, what do you mean by all? What does that mean to you? What is a totality? What does a full-throated absolutism mean to you? And does it just mean that anyone who's doing less than what I'm doing isn't doing enough? Because it's like, undoubtedly,
always find someone who's doing more.
Who's doing more. Exactly. And so I'm like, because the end game, truly, Aaron Bushnell showed us like that is, there's nothing left to give. He left all of the money that he had to the cause, and he gave everything that he is physically capable of giving to the cause. And so it's like, that's what totality looks like to me. If the question is, what does all look like to me? It's like, well, that's the example. That's all.
Yeah,
and that means that if we are saying your advocacy and your participation in this cause needs to be all or get the fuck out of the way, there's a lot of people who probably have something that they could contribute that falls well short of all, that we would rather have something from. It's sort of like if you were fundraising for a cause and someone's like, hey, I've got
all I have to give.
Yeah, I've got $10,000 in my bank account and I can give you $100. And we're like, why can't you give me $10,000? It's like, I'd rather have your $100. If you can give me $100, thank you. Like, we would rather have the $100 than zero from you. And I think that needs to be, I do understand,
on the flip end, to steel man the all or nothing position, I do think that there is something to be said with, especially for people like us who are just inherently in the imperial core, who are getting, and that's also why I don't look up to Nordic countries as much as other people do, is because inherently capitalism, regardless of how much reformism you do it or imperialism, falls the same. The inherent power structures that are there between the capitalist and the worker, or the imperialist and the subjugated people, it, no matter the reform, it will always be exploitative. So to me, I don't look at the Nordic countries that way, especially with regards to just generally Western countries still exploiting the global South whenever we get some sort of reform. We've seen that in the United States with us being like, yeah, we'll push for unions, but we'll also offshore all of these jobs so that we don't have to deal with the unions, so that we can just get the cheap labor abroad. And so as much as I see that, the thing with the all or nothing activism that gets to me is that I agree with the idea that we need to get more uncomfortable in the Western hemisphere, and also just in the imperial core, that we need to be uncomfortable, that we need to get used to it, because that is how we are going to enact change. And I agree with that. And I think that that's where the all or nothing kind of comes from, of like, get your ass out of your privilege and go do something. But the going doing something, that's the part where I think that we could be a lot more understanding, that given the level of propaganda that we are constantly consuming in the imperial core, given the communities that we have been raised in, given even like what you said earlier of like, most of us can't even dream of an alternative, given all of those conditions, we have to meet people where they're at. And for every single person and for every single activist that I know, their lines are going to be different. Like, for example, I know one of my close friends who's more of a social democrat. He is willing to organize with the true libs of libs, like the liberals who are blue dog Democrats, who believe that capitalism does have some inherently good qualities. People who I can't agree with that. And that's where his line is. My line is somewhere else. And I don't know exactly where it is, but I can tell you that there are some people that like I can agree that some people are like, you are too comfortable with regards specifically to, I think the Starbucks boycott is a good example for me of where people were genuinely getting on their phones and they're like, I cannot give up my Starbucks. I'm like, that's such a small ask. Like if we're not even talking about grabbing the pitchfork, I would
genuinely rather people just say like, I won't, because I don't really think that like me not buying coffee is actually going to affect anything, rather than say like, I can't. I'm like, hey, if you just want to be like, I don't actually think that like me not buying coffee from a place is going to like convince Benjamin Netanyahu to like change his genocidal philosophy. But like, you know, I get it that like money's, those are the pain points. I would prefer that to someone being like, I just can't. I'm like, oh no, you of course can. Like you absolutely, you absolutely can.
There was a time before you had Starbucks, I promise.
Yeah.
And you were alive then too. But in like, and even when I made my video, shit talking boycott fatigue with regards to Starbucks, I did, and I cut it because again, I'm like you, where people are always like, wow, this video is so long. Thank you for adding so much information. I'm like, you have no idea how much information I just cut out. But, and one of the things that I cut out was that I didn't include McDonald's when I was talking about boycott fatigue, specifically because of the context of food deserts. It felt too much of a broad stroke to be like, you can give that up, because I have met, just in my time as an EMT, I have seen communities where literally the McDonald's is the only food that is pre-prepared that is in their area. That's done on purpose, obviously. And so for me, that part I understand, but I do think that at least for me, my line is somewhere along the line of, if you are consistently, and I mean a majority of the time, choosing your comfort over your morals and your principles, then I think that ultimately you will not be a comrade of mine that sustainably stays in this fight. Not even that you're not someone that, like, I'm not going to go the length of being like, you're not a good friend or you're not a good person or anything like that. That's a separate conversation that I do think is interesting. But with regards to the movement, I will not spend my time organizing with you if I don't feel like you can do it sustainably. And to even your own morals, like not even applying my own morals, but if you come to me and you're like, I think that this boycott thing is really worth it, and I see you consistently choosing your comfort over that, that to me is indicative of you're just not maybe ready for this type of organizing. Not to say that people can't change, but I do think like the black and white and the in and out and the, I mean, I hear it all the time because like, I still don't know what I'm going to do in January, in November. I don't know who I'm going to vote for. PSL is trying to get on the ballot in Georgia. I would love to put my vote for someone who talks about seizing the top 500 companies of the United States. Do I think that they have a shot in hell in winning? Not at all. Do I think that it could send a message similar to FDR where it's like, you've got to play with us if you want to win next time? Yes. Is that a long-term strategy that I'm willing to bank on given what the Republicans have in store? I don't know. And then on top of that, is Joe Biden, one, even going to still be alive, but two, is voting for him also strategic in the sense of he is the better of the two for where we have seen a lot of movement and momentum and growth and inclusivity, which has been the union movement. So I'm like, Joe Biden is definitely better for that kind of organizing than Trump. But either way, I don't know. All of it is bad.
I'm really, really glad that I got you in here. You're so well spoken, and you're so like everything that you, every one of your positions, I trust you on, because it's so clear the amount of time and the amount of energy that you've put into like thinking about and considering your position. It's not just a thing that you're like, I watched a TikTok about it and I liked it. Like you very clearly come from a perspective where like you are putting in the work to try to formulate a really well-educated viewpoint, and it's really, really nice for me to listen to it. I really, really like hearing you elucidate your thoughts. Do you have time for me to ask you two quick things? Because we're like going over here, but I enjoy listening to you sort of break things down. So there's two things I want to like hear you give me an argument as to why I should like adopt this more, maybe even my audience, like think about this more, because like, you know, this is born out of a video of like arguing with people I don't disagree with. Cause there's also, when we talk about like maybe strategic differences or like stylistic differences, a few that have popped out just in this last section of discussion, when we're talking about Gaza and Palestine and this whole thing. One is, you mentioned how, even though you don't necessarily message this, your true philosophy is a one state solution, a free Palestine with full rights and dignity. Is inherent in that you believe in the eradication of Israel, that should be a no longer? And what does that mean to you, a one state solution?
Yeah.
Help me, because I hear that and I'm like, oh, I know that a lot of people would go, whoa, like you just talked about wiping out a country of several million people to obtain your, so can we get into that a little bit?
No, 100%. Actually, I got into a disagreement with specifically that with presidential candidate Dean Phillips. It did not end well. My position basically comes from, again, I think that it's heavily influenced by my French background of just looking how the French handled their past colonialist states. And the longer that they tried reformism and the longer that they tried to implement some sort of two-state, it always ended up in some sort of apartheid situation between the indigenous people and the immigrants. And I, for one, given my opinions on the border, I don't believe in borders, let alone really nation states. So I'm not really all about like, we can't have immigration. No, I think that immigration is a beautiful thing. And I think that it should be simplified for a lot of specifically Western countries, but especially in this case, like moving back to a country that you feel historical ties to, specifically for the Jewish population, that I don't feel any, I'm not religious, I'm not Jewish. So I can't imagine myself moving literally anywhere for a religious reason. However, if that speaks to you, I can understand that. My issue with Israel as a project and as a state is that it is not just built on the idea of immigration to somewhere where I feel cultural ties. It is dependent on the extermination of the indigenous population and its culture. And we've seen that over the past 75 years in different ways, from the Nakba to current, what is happening now since October 7th. And so to me, having any sort of Israel would imply having some sort of theocratic colonialist settler ethno state that the whole project stems from, this is our land, not yours. And that to me is indicative for so many future conflicts and for honestly to build a culture of supremacy for one group over the other, which is why it ended up being apartheid. So for me, when I say that we need to move towards Palestine being Palestine, the one state, and that being an equal place for all and with equal rights for all and not theocratic, that's why to me, I don't believe in like the expulsion. I do think that if you recently moved there and you are a recent settler, especially if you still have dual citizenship, then I do think that there should be policies that not forcefully reject, but that incentivize you returning to whatever dual citizenship you have, because you have the option for that. Just like I do think that there should be incentives as well as reparations for Palestinian refugees to come back. I think that that is definitely something that can be done through incentives, but I do not believe in the expulsion of any sort of Jewish communities. I just believe in the reparations and the destruction of a Zionist state. So also in this one Palestine, everyone would have like Jews as well as Palestinians, everyone would get to vote. And it would have no laws that are built on some sort of theocracy in my ideal world.
Yeah. And I think that's a good caveat to put on there, that it's like, ideally, this is what would be cool. Like
even Hamas is settling for 67 borders. So part of why I advocate so strongly for this is because I think that, again, compromise is always going to happen. So if I push for the ideal, I think that we're likely, it's very much the shoot for the moon. And if you miss, you land upon the stars or whatever, but instead now, to the Israeli
conflict. That's where I can actually get on board with you, is go, yes, as an ideal, like, it's like, this is actually what should be, actually ideally be the best situation for everyone. Where I get hung up and where I imagine a lot of people do is that they're like, they listen to that and go, yes, you're totally right about this theocratic colonialist state that fundamentally exists on the predicated assumption that it's like, it is ours, not yours, and we are pushing out the indigenous population, and that is a fundamental foundational problem of the existence of that state. And where I get tripped up is that I'm like, and yet here we are, like, and yet the state exists and the people within it who have been indoctrinated to to believe in its cause and its right to exist. And so I'm like, so what do you do about that? And you can't just go and tell all those people, you're now Palestine and that's good for you because you get to vote with all these people and you all get to get along, because they're going to get say, fuck you all the way to hell. We're going to, you know, like that will, so it's just like that won't actually happen. But I like putting the caveat on it of going, this is the, where we, like the thing that we think is
we're working correct, towards.
But if something with that idea, and it's sort of like going like, rightfully, there is so much stolen land in the United States. And yet it's like, what are you going to do about 350 million people built up in these communities? Like, you can't overnight just go like, this isn't yours anymore. And so it's like, ideally you go, this is what's correct. And this is what, this is, these are the harms and the sins that have been committed and that are like this, but it is the situation we find ourselves in. So I think,
will just add really fast, one little other caveat with it is that I do really look to South Africa, or I think it's Rhodesia, whatever. Both of those are good examples where it felt like they, specifically South Africa, but it felt like they could never reach no apartheid. It felt very much like no matter what, the white people are going to get pissed about the compromise, which seems to be the trend throughout history, but that's a whole separate thing. And so I do think that that's why, to me, as much as I do think that 67 borders would be a step in the right direction, we must always focus on strategies that will get us as close to that ideal, which do heavily involve on BDS of just boycott, divest, sanction. But I agree with you that to think that we could do that, even like even with the 10-year, 20-year timeline, like that's so crucial when it comes to climate change. But to think and to imagine things changing this much within our lifetimes is very hard to do.
Yeah, I think it's good to like break down these concepts, even though there's so much more that could be said to even further elucidate, like to actually like explain what you mean by those different regions in like South Africa and stuff. I don't think we have time for all of that, but I think it's good to try to elucidate some of these concepts just so that people don't hear like a thing and then they shut off because they go, what the fuck did she just say? You know, and then it's like, and then they, it's like, I think it's nice to get curious. Yeah. It's nice to get curious. Yeah. Like, what specifically do you mean by that? And that's the kind of thing that I'm trying to talk about lately on my show too. And in my space is like, before you shut down and stop listening, are there questions that you can ask that could help understanding more? Other thing that I wonder if we can take a quick moment to try to elucidate is as you see it, the efficacy of boycott measures when it comes to like Starbucks, Disney, McDonald's, things like this. I think it could be really easy to get kind of cynical about that and go like, I don't know if me not buying a latte from store or like how many millions of people need to effectively buy into a boycott like this before it before it has the kind of force that can actually move the needle at all. And I think what stops a lot of people from participating is just the idea of like, I don't really believe that me not buying a Big Mac is going to have an effect on what's happening in Gaza. And so if you could maybe try to offer an argument for that.
Yeah. I think for me, it's not even the boycott. I do have some cynical beliefs as well, just given the size of some of these corporations that I think about, even just the American market. Being not that important in comparison to the global hold that they have on whatever
India we're talking about, like
like they've got millions of people everywhere. And so to me, I agree with that. But to me, the more important part of it is kind of to practice and to get used to losing out on things that we thought that we couldn't easily give up. That to me is where I think that it's more valuable, not even the impact that it has on the company, because that to me, like I've seen those charts, I bet you have too, of like McDonald's plummeted and then like I see it coming back up, and I kind of never base my opinions on the funny little lines because the funny little lines do funny little things. So for me, I tend to focus more on like, how can I practice what I think? And if this is the babyest step, then this is a step that I need to get used to taking, that I need to get used to maybe, unfortunately, drinking that shitty gas station coffee, you know, like as much as Starbucks.
There's so much better coffee between gas station and Starbucks.
There is.
But for a lot of people, maybe not.
Okay?
Yeah.
No, exactly. For a lot of people. Yeah. And everything closes at like 6. We just got a new coffee shop that now closes at 8. So thank God I can get my caffeine fixed then. But like, it is something that I often think of, the Thomas Sankara quote of, you eventually have to decide between giving champagne for a few or water for all. And I think about that often in terms of, what are the things that I have gotten accustomed to in this Western society? I'm not saying like, you know, if you feel comfortable about not wearing deodorant, more power to you. However, I myself will stick to the clinical strength stuff for as long as possible until the system collapses. There are obviously going to be gradations for everyone, but I do think that all of us need to practice siding with things, even if we don't think that it's going to be that effective in the long run, but simply because it is muscle memory and showing ourselves that we can do it and that then we can do more. And also, I will say that with this, divesting from the system in general and from those mega corporations, I do hear the opposite side of like, but there are workers who are working those jobs. Of course, the workers make the company. Like, that's what got me to this communist belief to begin with, is that without the workers, you've got nothing. However, we do ultimately have to start stepping away from these mega corporations. And I do think that this is a good chance to do it. And I think that because it's for still a good cause, regardless of how effective it is, I think that it's the right thing to do. Similar to kind of how I feel about unions. Like, unions are not the end all be all, but they are practicing organizing. They are practicing negotiating with the people who do hold all the purse strings. So I think that that's incredibly useful, even if it's not as revolutionary as I would hope.
Fantastic. This is honestly, for my money, been like one of the best political discussions I've had on this podcast ever. You knocked it out of the park. I think you are an A+ guest. Like, you really, really just like brought the heat. And I really feel like there's like so much more that we could have said on every single one of those topics, but it's like the amount, I think that you and I speak in a similar way, where it's like a lot of volume.
Loquacious.
And I don't mean volume by like the decibel level. I mean, the amount of words that we're able to fit into, like a minute of time. And that's, yeah, loquacious is a much more, that's a much better word. But thank you so much for taking the time to do this with me. One more time, where can people find you if they want to follow your content and hear more about what
you're
doing?
Making me repeat it? Yeah. No, I appreciate the plug. And I really do just want to reiterate, thank you. I know that we talked about it before we went live, but thank you so much for working with me, for scheduling this. You were so nice. But yeah, people can find me on TikTok. It's Petite Leah, but without the E. So it's PTITE _ or .LIA. You'll find it. Good luck. And then on Instagram, it's socialist, as in just a socialist, and then SLOOTS, as in sleuths.
Amazing.
Socialist sleuths.
Great. Hey, chat, thank you guys so much for the lively conversation. I'm sorry we didn't get to a lot of what you were talking about, but I saw you following along, and thank you for keeping
it. I was reading them.
Yeah, like, it was a good discussion today, and we had a very engaged live audience. So thank you all so much for the engaged, lively discussion that went along with what we were talking about here. Yeah, cool. All right. Well, thank you. And that's all, I believe. Unless you have anything else, is there anything else that you were like, I needed to say this?
No, just I would be happy to come back anytime. But yeah, I really appreciate it. And thank you for the chat. Also.
I probably will ask you back, because that I mean, like, you absolutely crushed it. And I'm like, oh, we can do so much more then. So, yeah, cool. Thanks so much. And thanks, everybody. And that's all this time. We'll see you on the next time for it. Okay, then, bye. Seems like the opposite of what should be. Okay, that's the show. That's it. That's the whole thing. We'll probably have Leah on again, because I think there's a lot more we could talk about. Obviously, I think we were just scratching the surface with a lot of those topics. Interested to hear your feedback, your thoughts. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can, of course, find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com, austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, or by searching Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music, whatever it is, check out my double vinyl, Check out my Patreon, patreon.com/AustinArger. Check out my YouTube channel and my YouTube video essays, and subscribe to that channel if you haven't already. Okay, we'll see you next time. Take care of yourselves, take care of each other. Love you so much. Bye-bye. Shouldn't mean that I take everything.